Blog Talk Radio.
At Firefly Willows LIVE, we're working hard to be your trusted source for fun, enlightening, and heart-centered information and community. And we're passionate about the art of transformative media, the new leading edge of communication in our highly connected, media-rich world. If you're passionate about facilitating change and you have gifts or ideas you'd like to share, come join us. Host a show or be a guest or connect us to an amazing speaker or teacher whose message is too good to miss. There's always room for courageous, knowledgeable changemakers, inspired artists, and new ideas. Let us know you're interested. Send an email to info@fireflywillows.com. We're Firefly Willows, LIVE, helping you find and shine your inner light. Firefly Willows, LIVE presents Healing Conversations, featuring your host, Mildred Lynn McDonald.
Welcome, everybody. We're here for our weekly roundtable. I'd like to introduce three of my co-hosts, Heisi Luttimers.
Hello.
Deb Caracella.
Good morning.
And John Caracella.
Morning, everyone.
I was reflecting a little bit, and I thought to myself, if I had an opportunity to go back in time and meet the 20-year-old version of Mildred Lynn, would I have any nuggets of wisdom to share with her? And I came up with three things that I feel that she would have been very receptive and appreciative of hearing. So then I invited Heisi and Deb and John to do the same. We'd love to share that with you today, and maybe it'll trigger a conversation with yourself. The three things that came up for me were this. Be not afraid. Don't be afraid to be yourself. Don't be afraid to step out of the box. And don't be afraid to travel to the ends of the earth if that's what tickles your fancy. The second idea that came to me is your life purpose, or whatever drives your heart and your soul, whatever you came to the earth to experience and do, no matter how you try to squish it down or deny it or push it to the side, it's not going to go away. So treasure and activate those feelings as early as you can. And it took me a long, long, long time to make peace with that. And when I did, it was a huge relief and a huge release. The third aspect would be to let your creative side lead. I think I would have had a lot more fun if I did that. Because I do lead now with my creative side, and I'm having lots of fun. Now, who'd like to go next? Who'd like to share?
Well, wait. Yeah. Before you, so where would you have gone if you had not been afraid?
I would have gone to more artistic places. I would have explored things. I would have sewn more. I would have painted more. I would have danced more. I would have laughed more. I would have had more music in my life. Because I was holding myself back, I didn't let myself release and go into those places. I valued science and I valued business. And I thought they were the things that would get me to wherever I was supposed to be. Of course, I had no idea where I was supposed to be. I was afraid, and moving outside of those two squares was scary for me.
I think that the three little nuggets that I came up with actually very closely align with the things that you have expressed also, Mildred, that different from my 20-year-old self at my core. But I do think that at 20, I would have appreciated the acknowledgement and the affirmation to, one, be more willing to express my opinion, and two, to stay open to opportunities or experiences that I considered beyond my comfort zone. Three, to continue to trust my gut. So like you, I think I might have experienced traveling a little bit more freely. I would have experienced stating who I am more freely. And I would have enjoyed sort of leading with my creative side a little earlier than it actually happened.
And that's the continue to trust your gut thing?
I think that's probably more of the staying open to opportunities and experiences that I considered beyond something that was just a little outside of my comfort zone. In a sense, trusting my gut that I can take a chance here. I can explore this a little bit. I don't have to be quite that safe.
Why did you feel that you had to be safe?
It was just, I hadn't had that many experiences yet. I had the opportunity to travel to places as a child with my family, which was very much appreciated. I got to go out of state. I got to be on an airplane. So I had those opportunities and those little glimpses of what it meant to do something beyond the normal or the what was considered normal. But I'm a pretty quiet individual, and I don't have a lot of, I don't need a lot. So my comfort zone can be very, very small and contained, and I don't have to stay there. And that's what I mean about this being safe. It's okay to step out of what you feel is, all I need is this. I don't need to do that. But it's fun sometimes to experience that.
Deb, I really liked when you said that your core is pretty well the same.
I think so. I really don't feel that over the course of my years since I was 20 that I have changed that much, or that I wouldn't recognize myself now from when I was 20, or that I don't feel that the person I am now is not that person, that I'm a completely different individual. So yeah, I kind of do feel that at the core of who I am, it's stayed pretty true.
My mother kept letters that I wrote her when I was in university, and quite a few were from when I was 19, 20. And when I opened the letters the last time I was home, I could have written those letters today. I was stunned.
Yeah.
I didn't know quite what to make it. I looked at them and I thought, my heavens, you really expressed yourself well. Even with little flowers and drawings to emphasize points. But that was a stunning point to me. And I really had to think about, like you're saying, the core. I could see myself in those letters. I thought that a 19 or 20-year-old would be a diluted version of who I am today, but it wasn't like that at all. How about you, John, or Hi C?
I thought long and hard about all the things that I could have told my 20-year-old self that would have helped me avoid some of the challenges that I experienced in my life. And I had to really carefully winnow it down to the ones that my 20-year-old self would have listened to. Because there was a lot of things that I know now that I know my 21-year-old self would have said would not have either not have understood it or not have believed it and not have accepted it as truth. So I went with things that would just work their way into my psyche based on who I was at the time. And the first one was never stop singing. In my youth, I sang pretty much every day in school. Through most of my school age, I did a lot of singing, and it was really powerful and healing, and it always led me into a place of bodily truth. I felt clear when I sang. When I went to college, I kind of just stopped singing. I sang a little bit on and off after college, but I didn't really ever sing the way I did when I was in high school. And I think that would have saved me a lot of pain. The second thing was something a mentor shared with me, diagnosing a problem that I was having in dealing with my colleagues. He said, you know, you're a very articulate guy, John, but you don't speak to their listening. And I was like, what the heck does that mean? And so speak to their listening is actually something that I would have understood if it had been explained to me. Again, meet your audience where they are. Being sensitive to who that audience is and what their inclinations are and what their perspectives are. And if you can speak to their ability to hear you, what you say will be way more powerful than if you speak only from the place of your own experience. And that my 20-year-old self would have latched onto and incorporated into the discipline of his ensuing years. And the last one was discipline yourself to the terrain as well as the map. And that's code for me to step out of the vision space And, you know, because I did a lot throughout my career in crafting and sharing compelling visions. But a lot of the time, I left the reality of the facts on the ground by the wayside. If I had used the same kind of discipline that I used to hold the vision to integrate the actual ground that was surrounded all of us, I think everything that I shared through the capacities of my intellect and my vision would have been that much more grounded and that much more remarkable in its effectiveness.
Do you feel that these are three things that you've mastered now?
I do. I think there's a whole bunch of reality that has managed to find its way into my relationships with other people and my understanding of the terrain around me. So those second two, speak to their listening and discipline yourself to the terrain, are things that I'm starting to have been mastering over the last, I would say, 7 or 8 years. And the singing thing is just something that's coming in really clearly now over the last 8 months or so.
John, would you like to sing a song for our listeners?
Amen. Amen, amen, amen. How's that?
Wonderful. And Hi-C, would you like to do the next verse of that song?
No, I would not.
Now, let's imagine a 20-year-old Hi-C. What would you like to say to him?
Well, as I was listening to what the three of you were saying, you know, on the one hand, I think that both myself, I can look at this, at myself and say this, and I think a lot of people that knew me back then, if they knew me now, would say that I've changed very much. I would tend to think more that it's not so much that I've changed as it is that I've evolved by simply being able to become conscious of and develop untapped and unrealized potential that was there when I was 20, just needed some sort of catalyst to set it in motion, to start becoming more aware of and to become something more in how I actually live or see or approach in the world. And I think that my 20-year-old self would be receptive to what I would have to say, because I think that we don't want to underestimate who we were by seeing ourselves in kind of this box and this very narrow vision of who we think we were when we were 20, as if somehow we wouldn't have, you know, we would have just completely poo-pooed anything that somebody had said and we would have not listened at all. It might have been that some of those catalysts that came along later might have been set in motion earlier if our 20-year-old self heard this. So I don't want to underestimate my 20-year-old self either. And so the three things that I came up with, the first one is you are not alone. And that's really understanding that idea of interdependence and interconnectedness that all of us have. And it really helps to develop compassion, because it allows us to be able to see everyone else experiencing the human condition, and that therefore we can be more compassionate in how we see what other people are saying or doing or how they're acting, rather than simply seeing them as the other and thinking that they don't know what they're talking about or they don't know what I'm going through or, you know, whatever. But it also makes us more receptive to compassion from others, because we understand that if we're all connected, they can, on some level, understand who we are or what we're experiencing, rather than us feeling like nobody understands, which is probably a common refrain for teenagers and young adults. The second one is always asking the question, is it a matter of life and death? People make such a big deal out of everything. And we're also bombarded by things that make a big deal out of everything and inflate and put hyperbole on everything. I mean, just think of the media and how everything gets blown out of proportion into something that's the next end of the world apocalyptic thing and all sorts of stuff. Learning to say, is it a matter of life and death, puts it in perspective and says, you know, it's not really that big of a deal, so it's not really worth getting upset about or getting angry about or putting energy towards that saps me or drains me of energy that I could be using and focusing in a much more creative or productive way. It also reminds me anyway, by asking that question is do what you can and then allow that to be enough. Because unless it's a matter of life and death, but even if it is life and death, let's say that you saw somebody who had a heart attack on the street and you went over to try to perform CPR, even if they died, you don't have to feel guilty about that as long as you can say, I did what I could, rather than I should have been able to do more. And whether it's that dramatic or whether it's something simple, I think saying, is it a matter of life and death, says everything pales in comparison to the level of that question. So therefore, I learned not to make such a big deal out of everything. And then the third one is go deeper, to feed the spirit and also treat and remember that the body is the vessel of that spirit. Instead of just skipping along like if you tossed a rock along the surface of water, instead of just kind of skipping along and experiencing the surface of life or the surface of experiences, to stay with them, to go deeper into them, and also which means you have to allow yourself to be vulnerable and open up to what life and experiences have to offer you, rather than keeping things at kind of that surface level. But I think that's also part of that catalyst, that you start to develop the spirit or the spiritual side of yourself and much greater evolution and awareness starts to develop, which uncovers that untapped potential that we all hold. We just don't necessarily see it when we're only seeing and operating from the surface level.
I do have one last question that I'd like to ask Hi C and Deb and John. If your 20-year-old self met who you are today, do you think you'd be friends?
That's a good question.
Yeah, for sure. We would have kicked each other's butts. We would have just challenged each other left and right. It would have been awesome.
All right. And what about you, Hi C?
I think we would have been intrigued by each other and then seduced each other.
Well, at least you were 20.
And for myself, I feel that my 20-year-old self would have welcomed me. Actually, I feel like my 20-year-old self was looking for someone like me at that time. I think we have four thumbs up, don't we?
Yeah.
So I'd like to thank John and Hi C and Deb for sharing their three tips, which multiplied by four are 12 tips that everybody can take away. And I hope that you'll stay with us for the rest of the show. Thank you very much, John and Deb and Hi C, and stay tuned for more.
Thanks, Mildred.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, that's our roundtable for this week. Many thanks to Mildred Lynn McDonald and participants Deb and John Carosella and Hi C. Ludmers. We hope you found this roundtable discussion engaging and thought-provoking. If you would like to join the conversation, visit facebook.com/fireflywillows and add your comment under this week's roundtable post. Stay tuned. As promised, we're always thinking of ways to bring you a fresh new perspective. Check out this lineup of our newest shows. The Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist, featuring Firefly Willow's LIVE favorite, Hi C. Ludmers, and his co-host, Charlie Harrington, on the second Tuesday evening each month. A Shamanic Life, hosted by John Carosella, on the first and third Tuesday evenings each month. The brand new Embracing Change, The Joy of a New Path, with career coach Ivan Teams and John Carosella, the fourth Tuesday evening of each month. What's Your Prescription for Balance, with Mildred Lynn McDonald and her co-host, Dr. Glenna Calder, the first Thursday afternoon each month. And Evolve, with Robin White Turtle Lisney, the third Thursday afternoon each month. We're excited. Give us a listen as we continue to create new and entertaining ways for you to shine your inner light. Join us at Firefly Willows, LIVE.
Hello, this is Mildred Lynn McDonald, and I'm your host for Healing Conversations, live from Sebastopol, California. Thank you very much for joining us today. In a few minutes, we'll chat with Dr. Margaret Steller, a talented, pioneer-spirited, naturopathic doctor who has a PhD in plant breeding and genetics. Margaret's passion for plants began at the tender age of 4 as she explored her mother's garden. Over the years, she's discovered the amazing benefits of plants as they're used for medicine and for food. In her California-based practice, she uses the tenets of Dr. Edward Bach to treat the person, not the illness. She's also guided by the philosophy of Luther Burbank, who felt that love was the greatest force for healing and to help us realign with nature. A little later in the show, we'll beam over to Salt Spring Island, British Columbia, to talk with Lorraine Game, an award-winning poet, writer, teacher, editor, and writing and creativity coach. Lorraine will entice us with how she manages to stay in a state of harmony so creativity can flourish and thrive. Plus, she'll grace us with her poetry. And now, without further ado, let's welcome Dr. Margaret Steller to the show. Margaret, welcome to the show. I want to share with our listeners that Margaret and I have had several conversations about plants, and I find the topic area absolutely fascinating, and I know that our listeners will too. So, Margaret, can you share with me and with people who are listening, how did you get interested in plants, and how old were you?
When I was just a child, my mother had a fairly complex perennial garden, and there were a lot of kids in my family, and so to keep us busy, she used to have me help her weed her flower garden, and she had to, you know, show me what were the flowers, what were the weeds, but I absolutely fell in love with the flowers and learned them and how to, you know, be careful around them and all that. And by the time that I was 9 years old, I'd been selling seeds for school and mostly to the neighbors and all that, but I would pore over the seed list of what there were, and we would buy vegetable seeds for our own family garden, but I was always wanting to buy flower seeds.
Oh, really?
And so when I was in fourth grade, I simply told my mother, "Mama, let me do it. I know what I'm doing." And I had placed my flower seed order, and they came in, and I was just like hooked. And she gave me her flower garden. I couldn't believe it, really. So, you know, I had peonies and delphiniums and bleeding hearts and just beautiful, beautiful flowers to interact with. And some of them were shrubs, like the mock orange. And it was just great. And then I planted my seeds, and they came up, and I would spend time out in the garden as much as possible.
I think that people are probably going to be contacting you to invite you to come and help them with their gardens.
Well, I've been known to do it.
So when you look at plants or when you feel a plant, what do you see? Because as you're talking about a garden and plants and flowers in such a loving way, it seems to me that you're seeing things maybe ordinary people aren't seeing in the plants, or the benefits of plants. Can you share a little bit about that?
When I'm looking at plants, oftentimes I talk with them.
Mm.
And I tell them how beautiful they are and how, wow, they're growing so great. So I actually see them as beings, individual beings, and interact with them in that way. And sometimes I'll touch them, caress their petals, and talk to the bees while the bees are doing their thing with the flowers, and say, "Oh, you're doing such a good job helping this flower out," and, you know, doing, just interacting with the plant as though it's like a person.
And it sounds like you're in a place where you're valuing and appreciating the plant.
Absolutely.
Because
I absolutely do.
Yeah, because you're putting the plants on the same plane as you would talk to a person. A person could be walking with you, and you may be having this, a similar form of conversation.
Right. And I always stop and I smell flowers. And I'm like walking along and I see a beautiful like rose or lavender plant, and I'll brush my hands across the lavender and then smell it, smell my hands, or bend over to sniff the roses. I like to look at dandelions. All the flowering plants are gorgeous to me. And I also like vegetables very much, but my favorites are flowers.
Now, when you were a little girl and you were in your mom's garden exploring and discovering the beauty of plants and flowers, is that where you started to realize that you could have this conversation?
I don't know exactly. I have to say that the plants were a great source of comfort to me.
Okay.
And so I would rush out of the house in the morning and go out to see the progress of growth that my garden had made overnight.
Wow.
To see what new things were blooming and how much taller they might have gotten. Because plants do a lot of growing in nighttime. I was receiving a lot back from the plants at the same time that I was giving a lot to them.
Our listeners out there who are looking for a form of comfort in their lives or a way to de-stress or bring more fulfillment in may want to consider this type of relationship with flowers or plants or vegetables.
I would recommend that because plants have so much to give us.
Mm-hmm.
They just want to please people so very much. And so by developing a relationship with the plant kingdom, by having a plant or two plants or a small garden in your backyard or plant in your office, it's a way to expand your realm to include another type of being and live individual to care for them and to receive their care. You can have a conversation with a plant and they actually seem to listen to you.
Now, when we talked before, you introduced me to a very important person in the plant world called Luther Burbank. I was intrigued because he inspired you so much, so I'd love to invite you to share with our listeners, why is he an important man in your world, and what benefits can he offer with his philosophy?
Luther Burbank was the greatest plant breeder that ever lived. And he lived in the last century. He was born in the 1800s and then died, I think, around 1936, 1950s. He came up with varieties of plants that still exist today, like the Burbank potato or the Shasta lily or the Santa Rosa plum. When I first started graduate school to study plant sciences, I started out in plant pathology, and it bothered me to inoculate plants with diseases. And a plant pathologist said, well, why don't you become a plant breeder?
Oh.
And so I said, okay, I'll look into that. And I was totally taken by it. And as I studied more plant genetics and the traits of plants and how to do hybridizations and things like that, I became more familiar with Luther Burbank, and I really came across who he was as an individual in the book Autobiography of a Yogi, because Yogananda went to Santa Rosa to meet Luther Burbank, who he considered to be a saint. And his chapter in his book is called A Saint Among the Roses, because he was just in awe of who Luther Burbank was and his relationship with nature. What he was really fascinated with is how Luther Burbank could bring his spiritual nature into his work as a plant breeder and accomplish things that people hadn't been able to do before, like cross species of plants that had never been able to cross in the past. And he did it by inspiring the plants through his divine connection, or his connection with his divine, and love. Yogananda was like really in awe of him because there was such a direct implication for what that relationship could have. His whole life was really about service to mankind and creating beauty and to create food crops. It was just part of his nature. He created flowers that were really gorgeous, and new fruits. He was, I think, instrumental in producing the first pluot, which is an apricot plum cross. And the other thing is that he could get walnuts that you could eat. And he came up with a spineless cactus that cattle could eat. It could be a fodder for cattle that would be in desert areas, because cactus grow really well in the desert. Mm-hmm. And alfalfa and all that takes a lot of input, and it doesn't grow so well in the desert.
Were those crops able to reproduce themselves?
Well, a lot of his plants would have been seed plants, but many of them were what you would call a clone. So they'd be propagated clonally, which means that they would be propagated by cuttings or by buds, so it would be the exact same genetic background. Other hybrids, like annual seeds that you might buy a packet of something and plant it in your garden,
mm-hmm.
you have to maintain the parent lines and make the crosses annually to have new seeds available for people to plant in the garden.
Okay, I get you.
But you can still go to a nursery and get a Santa Rosa plum tree that is the identical genotype as the one that he produced, 100 years ago, Burbank potato.
I heard of Burbank potatoes. I interviewed Roberta Coker last year on the show, and we were talking about, she was from Santa Rosa, and she mentioned mm-hmm. the home of Burbank potatoes. And at that time, it didn't mean anything to me. Mm-hmm. Now it does.
Well, the interesting thing about the Burbank potato is he was upset about the Irish potato famine.
Oh.
And he created the Burbank potato to be more productive and to have some disease resistance. By selling the Burbank potato for I don't know what, that was how he managed to move from Massachusetts, where he was from, to Santa Rosa, which he thought was the greatest paradise on earth
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
for growing things.
Yeah, and he's correct. Living here now, I have to agree with him. How do you apply his philosophy in your naturopathic practice?
Well, the thing is that Luther Burbank believed that almost anything could be overcome with love.
Okay.
And when people come to see me in my office, they become part of a group of people that I care for. And when I'm working with people, like I do cranial sacral therapy, people feel as if it's the touch that they receive is like a mother's love.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm working with them, and that's the energy that comes through my hands to the individuals that I'm working with. When I'm coming up with remedies for them, say I'm coming up with a treatment plan and I'm using botanic medicine or nutritional supplements, I think of them in a loving way, and I'm creating medicine that will heal them as people, not just as a body, not as an illness, but as a person. And when you can think of a patient as a person, and you're wanting to help them, that love comes through to them in their care.
Okay, I understand. And I'm wondering, how can others do this too? Like, what would you recommend? Because you're very learned in these areas, and I know there's people out there, and they're saying, I really like what she has to say. I really like Luther Burbank's approach. I wonder how I could apply that in my own life.
Well, I can't say I'm a master at it.
Okay.
I'm still a student. I'm
going
to say that first of all, because I can still get irritated and get charges, as they're called. But if I can get myself in that zone, I find that I'm far more effective than if I'm not. And so the way to get there is to focus on something of beauty. Find something that you can just focus your attention on that is beautiful. That could be anything. It could be the design of a lamp, the lines of the lamp that you have in your office, or a photograph, or look out the window and see something beautiful there. Connecting with nature is a good way to find something beautiful. Inspiring photos around your office or different things to look at.
Maybe music? Would that be something?
That's another way.
Okay.
Or thinking of people that you actually have a relationship with and really care about deeply. And then if you're in that state, it's easier to transfer it to others.
Another source of inspiration for you, and I would say an anchor person, because Luther Burbank seems to be a cornerstone person, and the other person that you had shared is Edward Bach.
Yes.
Bach Flower Essences. And when you mentioned the time frame when Luther Burbank lived, that was almost around the same time as Edward Bach.
Edward Bach, I think, was just a little bit earlier.
Okay.
I'm not sure, but their lives were contemporaries.
Okay.
I don't know if they knew each other. Or not. I don't say that I know that. But Edward Bach is an inspiration to me because he had a communication with plants and it was intuitive. He had an intuitive connection with plants where he could understand the way plants would help treat various emotional states of upset. And his whole thing was he treated the person, not the illness, and he felt that all illnesses originated from emotional states that were out of balance. And so that if he could correct the emotional state, their bodies would correct themselves. And he could always apply some medicine too. He was a doctor, a medical doctor, trained in England. And that's where he did his life's work, pretty much, there in Scotland and Wales. He was very intuitive. By creating his flower remedies to help people's emotional states and, you know, say that this, you know, if he would read the type of conditions that the person exhibited and then say, take this flower remedy, this will help you. And he gave up his scientific approach and just went with his intuition.
How do you take his work and apply it in your naturopathic practice?
I'm learning to expand his work in my practice.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing I can tell you that most people in our society exhibit is stress. They come into my office and they're like all worked up about something. Somebody called them. Somebody told them something. They were in traffic. Maybe they were in a car accident. And it's like, get some Bach flower remedy, rescue remedy, and keep it in your purse. Just keep it with you. Have some at home. Have some at your desk at work. And if you're feeling this state coming on, use it. So many, many of my patients, I just say, have it available to you. And the other way that I use it is if a person, I'm working with a person and they're stuck, they don't get beyond, you know, I'm working with them and they're not progressing from the state they are in their illness to a higher state. Then I look into their emotional state and I prescribe a Bach flower remedy or two,
mm-hmm.
maybe, you know, more than one to help them. And they oftentimes say, wow, this really helps. I was really depressed and or I wake up depressed and I take my remedy and I'm not depressed. And I can, you know, make it through the day and, you know, feel better.
What other type of remedies would treat what other symptoms? Is there one for worrying or one for?
There's some that are very specific to different cases. And if I just look at something here, I'm looking at, for example, addiction.
Mm-hmm.
I have a book on my desk called The Flower Essence Repertory. And so there are about 20 different flowers that could be used for addiction, but they're from different types of addiction. For example, sunflower says it's for people with low self-esteem associated with drug usage to develop a healthy self-image.
Mm-hmm.
Or peppermint is for promoting a more awake state without stimulant drugs. There's more than one type of flower essence work. There's the Perilandra system, there's the California flower essences, and then other individuals like Earth Current Gardens. It's a woman I know in Oregon called Kathy Mary Ration that she has this connection with plants so that she can create flower essences. People can do it. you and I could do it mm-hmm. if we had that, you know, intuitive connection or focused on it. I could say you probably have it and I could have it too, but I haven't focused on creating essences. My main thing is using the essences.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, when we go back to nature, because mm-hmm. talking about Luther Burbank and Edward Bach, it really makes me think about how people today, people that you're coming across in your everyday life and in your practice, how they regard their relationship with nature.
I think that many, many people just think of nature as something at their disposal or to use.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, hiking through the forests or being out here, we're on the Delta, what they call the Delta, or the San Francisco Bay. It's available for them to use for boatage or whatever. And the thing is that when people get out of their own way with nature, they're hugely inspired by it. Like if you go to Yosemite and see the Half mm-hmm. Dome, people are like in awe of that because it's like it really is awesome to see this gigantic granite mountain face. People are inspired by the ocean or other types of really powerful experiences like seeing the redwoods for the first time or Crater Lake. But the thing is that they can be inspired by nature every single day just by looking around them and marveling at the song of the mockingbird. And so if you just listen to the mockingbird singing, it's really astonishing.
If we choose as a people not to connect or cultivate this relationship with nature, it sounds like we're missing out on so much on so many different levels. And there must be a price to that.
Well, I think that people then are cut off from really an energizing source of inspiration in their lives. I often think about this. That is that we are coming through like winter. Plants have dropped all their leaves mostly, and they renew their lives every spring. They put out new leaves. They produce fruits. They produce flowers, and it's just like they just do it. The thing is, if the plants can do it, we can do it.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
We can renew ourselves every day just by choosing to do it. We can choose and know that deep inside ourselves we're capable of it.
So if you were going to offer someone, let's say, two or three tips on how to strengthen their connection with nature or plants or flowers or birds or the Grand Canyon, what would you throw forward?
To be in contact with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like be outside, feel the air, just like start being in your senses about it. See it, feel it, hear it. You could, you know, if it's something you can taste, go ahead and taste it. If it's safe to taste, not if you don't know what it is. But like fruit, for example, or fresh spear of asparagus out of the garden. I mean, that's a pretty powerful experience, just to experience it straight up. And then to have something that's a special plant to them, you know, like either on their desk or out in their garden or wherever they choose to have it. Just start to notice how things change around them, like to notice the seasons. Like when I'm from Minnesota originally, and I would notice that the plants in the winter or the trees had on their winter coats. They looked like they actually had on coats. And then in the spring, their bark would green up a bit, and they looked like they had on their spring jackets.
Mm.
You know, and then in the summer, they're so lush with the leaves, very, very lush, beautiful green leaves. And then in the fall, things start to change, and the color starts fading. And then if it's a place where there's cold weather, then you get that glorious change of colors, you know, the oranges and the yellows and the reds. And so it's just like something to notice instead of just saying, oh, that's a tree. You know, it's kind of meditative.
Yeah.
And so you can de-stress. It's a de-stressing thing to do.
Now, when you're looking at people and talking to people and interacting with people, do you notice any characteristics that may be associated with what's called nature deficit disorder? People who are not inclined to be in tune or in harmony with nature, the lack of that connection is hurting them in some way. Do you ever come across that?
I haven't really treated it as a condition per se in my office.
Mm-hmm.
But in thinking about it, there are people that I can say are totally cut off. But they're not just cut off from nature. They're cut off really from themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They just kind of go through their day and do whatever. But I remember years ago when I was walking around, I was visiting a friend in Evanston, Illinois. And I was looking at the people that were just kind of like walking around. They were just like walking around. And that's a suburb of Chicago or a city just north of Chicago. And they almost seemed like they were gray colored.
Mm.
You know, like their skin was gray. It had gray tones to it. And they just didn't have any light about them. And I would say that that probably is the condition you're talking about. I perceived it as that. Okay, because I perceive things in different ways than people do, because
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I am intuitive. That's how I perceived it. And if I would ask somebody, do those people seem gray to you? They would say, I don't know what you're talking about. But that would be how I would see it. And it just seemed like they were just like caught up in a life that was cut off from nature. I mean, that campus was right on, it was Northwestern, right on Lake Michigan, and the waves were gorgeous to look at. There was a lake shore. There were plenty of trees, but they were more focused on the inside of their buildings and their work. And the other thing is just they seem never to be breathing fresh air,
mm-hmm.
you know, like outside plant-generated new oxygen. They just seem to be rebreathing the same air that they had breathed 100 breaths before.
And that would exactly be the case, wouldn't it?
It would, if they're in these buildings that are sort of sealed off and no natural light. Many of them don't have windows. I mean, people, you can always hear it. I have a window at my office.
That's right.
And it's like, I have a window at my office? Like, you can live without a window. I can't.
So if there's someone listening who's saying, oh, my heavens, that's me,
mm-hmm.
simple solution, bring a plant in?
You can bring in a plant. And the other thing is you can create windows by having artwork on the walls.
Beautiful idea.
Or something like an inspiring picture of nature. Because I've had offices like that where I was in a cubicle sandwiched between people. And it's like, what can I do? So I brought in all these beautiful pictures so that if I felt like I was suffocating, I could look at the pictures and be inspired.
Yeah.
And then just walk outside every once in a while and get some fresh air.
You were present in mind and body of your surroundings, that this particular surrounding is not, although it's paying the bills or whatever,
mm-hmm.
it's not nourishing me. It's not nourishing my soul. It's not nourishing my body. So you decided to have an antidote for that, which would be the beautiful windows in the form of pictures or photographs or artwork and plants and
exactly.
going outside. So they were the three things that you would do.
And the other thing you can do, any person could do this, you can replace the light bulbs in your office with
mm-hmm.
full-spectrum bulbs.
Okay.
So that you can get the full nourishment of sunshine, because full-spectrum light bulbs have that. And I did that in a number of my offices. So I would just, at my own expense, buy full-spectrum light bulbs
mm-hmm.
and either put them in myself, or if it was like a fluorescent light, I'd ask the maintenance person if they could install them. They're like, well, I don't know why you're taking these perfectly good light bulbs out of here. I say, well, I prefer these.
And how much are they? Are they expensive?
They can be a little more expensive, but the value, I would find people would walk into my office and lean into the light.
Ah, okay.
So there's something that is very tangible about full spectrum lighting.
It's almost like a flower. It turns its face to the sun. That's what it sounds like to me.
People really do it. Check it out. Just kind of have lighting in your own space, some of it artificial and some of it the full spectrum, and to see where people wind up.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. You're going to take your knowledge and your experience and your perspective and your heart and create some courses to offer to people. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
The classes I'm hoping to teach, and I will teach, a class at the Energy Medicine University that's in Sausalito, based in Sausalito, on the Bach flower remedies. And it will be a class on how their origins, their uses, the types, what's the indications, the scientific basis of the prescribing the flower remedies, so that a person can be a practitioner of the Bach flower remedies so that they can use them within their practice. Other classes are on plants,
mm-hmm,
and having the relationship with plants for gardening, for use in your life, and is botanic medicine. That's a whole nother study of plants. And I think that, you know, nature's pharmacy is far more powerful than prescription drugs any day.
So when you say botanic medicine, what does that mean?
Just to give people an idea, when they first were tackling malaria over 100 years ago, they used a plant medicine called quinine, and that's how they treated malaria. Eucalyptus. People still use eucalyptus when they have sinus conditions to help clear their sinuses out. That's an external kind of application. You smell in the eucalyptus scent, and it helps clear the vapors of the eucalyptus oil, help clear your sinuses. The plant kingdom has remedies for us to treat many different conditions.
So what we're saying is mind, body, spirit, whatever ails you or whatever combination ails you, to be well informed in terms of what plants you can bring to the table as part of the overall solution. And really, most people aren't educated in that area today.
No, they're not at all. In the days of our ancestors, they had to know what plants to use or know the local herbalist in their community to get help. And, you know, modern medicine will poo-poo that kind of help that people could get. But the Native Americans used many different herbal remedies, and that man that fell in the glacier in Switzerland or Italy or wherever it was, he had his little first aid pack with him that they talk about.
Okay.
That he was carrying certain dried herbs with him in case he got sick or had certain things happen, because they knew, people did know that you could use certain plants to heal different conditions. Now, I'm not against modern medicine. I'm not. I think modern medicine is great. But there's also a place in our world for what plants have to offer us. Just like with the Bach flower remedies, people can change their emotional state. In the U.S. especially, the most highly prescribed prescription drugs are antidepressants and anti-anxiolytics.
Oh.
It's like, okay, so people are walking around depressed and with anxiety and taking, you know, Prozac or whatever they're taking to lift their mood up. And it's like, maybe they could just take a flower remedy, relearn how to connect with nature so that they can be re-inspired in their purpose for being alive. People are depressed because they don't know what their purpose is.
Or they're giving their purpose away. Mm-hmm.
People can be. That's the beauty of it. It's not a, you missed it. So, sorry, you're on antidepressants the rest of your life. It can happen at any time. All you have to do is go outside or see something that is beautiful.
The other thing that I found personally from moving to an area that's bursting with life force energy in the form of nature, plants, trees, birds, grasses, flowers, is that the more you go out in nature, the more your heartbeat or your natural rhythm aligns with nature. And I call it the great sifter, because you're out there and things that may be occupying your mind or maybe something you're concerned or worried about that doesn't merit your time or attention just dissolves away. So it's almost like a compass or a tuning fork. And if you can get into that flow of having your heartbeat be in tune or singing a song with nature's heartbeat, you feel like you're getting such substantial support and nourishment.
That's so true. You can even take it a step further and just say, we're living on this great planet, and we're being supported totally by the planet. If you just kind of take it back even a step further and say, everything that I need is being provided to me. The air, water, food, shelter, everything. And who is this being that's supporting me? I'm standing on her crust, the crust of the earth. And it's unbelievable when you could say that it's not just nature, it's a living being that this planet is.
I'll be shifting my thought pattern there the next time I go out. Thinking Mother Nature.
Yeah, Mother Nature, Gaia, whatever people want to call our planet.
Over the next year or the next couple of years, you have such a unique perspective and you have a lot of knowledge and experience and a really, really good heart. Where would you like to focus your efforts? Is it research or teaching or your practice?
I'm growing. I'll just say I'm growing and shifting my own perspective about what I'd like to do. And I want to always maintain a private practice because I love working with people and I love working with their health. But I'd also like to share what I know in the form of teaching. I'm a credible academic. I've spent many, 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 many years of my life learning things, and I want to share those things with others to help them learn and have the benefit of all that I know. I am incredibly interested in energy medicine, and I've been doing some experimenting since 2003 in doing distance work with that. My furthest cases of working with people doing energy medicine are the Ivory Coast of Africa and Germany, from California this is. I'm doing it over Skype or doing it over the telephone, and I do have a research degree. My PhD is a research degree, but I would rather work more with my intuition and that aspect of myself, the deeper, more spiritual aspects of myself, to explore what I can do for humanity. That's the direction I'm going. I don't want to spend my time writing research grants and doing research. I wouldn't mind being the subject of research, you know, with the energy medicine. I would love to participate in that. But I really want to be in the doing mode more so than in the research mode. Maybe that will shift again. I don't know. But I also want to do more plant breeding.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
I just absolutely love doing plant genetics. You know, I went back to school and I became a naturopathic doctor. And so I got away from it a little bit, and I want to go back to it. That's something I want to do. And then I just want to exploring the idea of having a healing center where people could come and spend time, and part of it would be helping to grow organic food and working in gardens, flower gardens, beautiful healing gardens, because a lot of hospitals are putting in gardens because they found them to be such a healing environment. And just to have kind of a retreat place that I myself live and work. I would like that. I'm kind of exploring different options as I'm going along. It's unfolding.
And what's your fertilizer? What are you fertilizing yourself with?
Well, grace, I guess. That's what I would say. Grace.
Okay, yeah.
I asked for to have more grace in my life.
Mm.
And that's about the best fertilizer you can get.
Yeah, I agree. Margaret, I'm really intrigued with where you're going with all these different areas. So would you consider coming back in about 6 months and giving us an update?
Oh, I'd love it. I would really love to do that.
I'd especially like to hear about the plant breeding.
The plant breeding actually takes a piece of land and some resources and time.
Okay.
That's what I would say it takes. But I've had some ideas of things that I would like to do. They're mostly flowers because that's my, like I said before, my first love is always flowers. And that's why I actually went to get a PhD is because I wanted to be a flower breeder.
Ah.
And I got diverted off into fruit, strawberries. Oh. And I love that too. But flowers are my favorite thing to work with. And so I've had some ideas and that's something that I would like to just pursue.
The plant breeding and also the energy work that you're exploring. I think they would be two great topics to talk about a little bit down the road.
Yep, because it's very different for me whether I have my hands on someone or if I am doing it distance. When I'm working with people with my hands, I feel things through my fingers,
mm-hmm.
my whole hands, and I sense things that way. When I'm working with them distance, it's like I'm seeing things almost at a molecular level. In my mind's eye. So it's very, very different.
Margaret, if someone wanted to get a hold of you
mm-hmm.
and have a conversation or experience distance healing or whatever, do you have a website?
I do. It's www.madronanaturopathichealthcare.com.
And could you just spell out Madrona?
Madrona, it's actually a tree in the Pacific Northwest. It's MADRONA. My email address is listed, and so is my phone number. I chose the name Madrona because it is a tree of the Pacific Northwest, but it's also a very feminine tree. Just the look of it, the shape of the leaves, the smoothness of the bark, it's very feminine. And I think a lot of healing is a feminine art. That also the tree as it grows sheds its bark, which we can also do. We can shed experiences that no longer serve us. And then the other thing about the Madrona tree is that if a forest fire goes through and burns the tree down to the soil line, it can regenerate itself from a burl that's under the soil, and that tree can regrow. It's like the phoenix coming out of the ashes. And that's why I chose that tree as a symbol of the name of my practice.
Wow, all the thought that went into that.
I did actually think about it a long time.
So, Margaret Stoller, I would like to thank you for being on the show today, and I would encourage all of our listeners to visit Margaret's website, and we'll all look forward to hearing more about her adventures. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mildred Lynn. I really enjoyed being a guest on your show.
Firefly Willows, LIVE, is committed to being an alternative voice and passionate about the art of transformative media, the new leading edge of communication in our highly connected media-rich world. That is why we acknowledge the animal and wildlife rescue organizations and volunteers who so generously gift their valuable time and energies to their communities. If you work with such an organization or know of one that you feel provides a service to their community that we can share, contact us at info@fireflywillows.com. As we enter the midpoint of the year, we'd like to again acknowledge the following groups for their work and efforts on behalf of the animals, wildlife, environment, and their communities. The Wildlife Center of Silicon Valley, Hidden Villa of Los Altos Hills, Underdog Railroad Rescue of Portland, Oregon, and Bright Haven Sanctuary of Petaluma. Thank you for all you do.
Many thanks to Dr. Margaret Stoller for being on the show today, and we'll look forward to catching up with her again to enjoy updates on her plant adventures, energy medicine, new courses, and other activities. This is your host, Mildred Lynn McDonald, and you're listening to Healing Conversations live from Sebastopol, California. We hope that you're enjoying the show today. In a few minutes, we'll be off to Salt Spring Island, British Columbia, to connect with Lorraine Gain, award-winning poet, writer, teacher, editor, and writing and creativity coach. We're in for a fascinating tour on how to create more harmony, balance, relaxation, and even inspiration in your world by following a nature-rich daily practice, something that you can do at home and even while traveling. As a special treat, Lorraine will also grace us with one of her poems. And now, let's welcome the wise, the warm, and the insightful Lorraine Gain to the show. I'd like to welcome everyone to the show today, and we have Lorraine, who is situated in Salt Spring, British Columbia, and from what I understand, Lorraine is enjoying a beautiful cup of nettle tea, if I'm saying that properly.
Yes, it's nettle tea that I've picked from our property and dried the leaves and brewed, and it's very delicious and sweet.
One thing I wanted to ask you about, and I'm sure many, many people who are listening would love to know about, it's your daily practice of walking in the woods and how it brings you joy and balance and harmony and fulfillment. I know you do this every day, and I'm wondering, was there a specific trigger that created the invitation to start this practice?
This practice actually started while I was in Toronto. I was working as a full-time editor and quit my job to write. And I found that I just settled into a natural rhythm of yoga and writing in the morning. I found that sometimes when I walked, this enhanced the whole process, particularly when I arrived on Salt Spring Island. It just seemed to be a very natural way to start the day, because as I walk, it's very meditative, and I have also a practice of looking and listening, so I often see things that I write about, so this is very inspiring for me.
So when you're watching and looking and listening, can you give our listeners an example of what might capture your attention on one of your walks?
The property where I live is a 20-acre property of old-growth cedars and firs. So there's animals and birds of every kind. One day recently, for instance, there were two owls in the trees, and I had never seen them before because owls don't like to be seen, and this was the morning. So it was quite startling when I saw two of them in broad daylight. Another day there might be eagles. There's a creek I walk by, so there's ducks and geese, and there's a lot of deer. Really, there's almost any type of animal that you can imagine that might appear. So one has to be very alert just to see what's there.
Do you look for these things, or do they just appear to you?
They often just appear. Not every day, but often. You have to have sort of soft eyes and really open your ears just to notice. And no, it's very magical, and it's always a wonder to me what I will see.
I love your expression, soft eyes.
Yes, I found in my practice of writing poetry, that's essential. If you see with your ordinary eyes, often you don't see much. You're just looking in a ordinary, hard way. But if you soften your eyes, you can see the essence of things. And things appear much more magical, like flowers or the shape of trees, the creek or mist over the trees. So it's very good for poetry in terms of metaphors and similes and that kind of thing.
With your daily practice, you get up in the morning, and then what happens?
Okay. I get up in the morning and make a cup of tea and do some yoga meditation. Then I'll go out for a walk. And usually it's about 10 or 15 minutes. Then I'm back writing. And I'll be writing for most of the morning or doing writing-related things, like I might be working on a poem, an essay, or other writing. And I may go for two or three other tiny little walks just to break it up. I find that the walking and the writing really is a nice rhythm. Then I'll have lunch, and in the afternoon I do business-related things, and then I go for another walk, this time to a lake nearby where there's a labyrinth that I walk, and then I'll walk home and carry on with my day, dinner, etc.
Lorraine, I think you mentioned to me when we talked before that even if you're in a city or somewhere else other than your property, you're still able to do your daily practice. And I was really intrigued by that because that could be a hurdle for people. So I'm wondering if you could share what that looks like.
I often go to Toronto where my family lives and I carry on with my practice. It's just really a matter of establishing a routine and sticking to it. So in the morning, I'll get up, make tea, do my yoga, and then go right to writing. I don't often always go out in the morning for the walk, but I can. You know, it's just to take a walk around the block, that kind of thing, limber up the legs, and then again, write until noon and then do other things. So you can do this practice anywhere. It's not location specific, more your intention.
Yeah, I like that. It's your intention. You're investing your time and yourself and your heart and your soul into your practice. So there must be a benefit. And I'm wondering, how does it make you feel?
Well, this practice of walking and writing is very harmonious. It makes me feel calm, inspired, delighted, very balanced. It's very good for the whole body because when you're out in nature, you're just in a state of calmness and your breathing generally tends to be very rhythmic. Just overall, it's a beautiful state to be in.
Would it be fair to say you're in some form of altered state?
Yes, I would say this because as soon as you do these practices, which are very meditative, you are in a more relaxed state. That's how I would call it. And it's very easy to create in a relaxed state, either to write or to paint or do anything. So when you say altered, I would say relaxed and inspired and open. You're just in an open state.
Opening the door and letting a beautiful gust of fresh air in.
Yes, that's exactly it. You're open to anything that might happen, so you're open to surprises. You're open to miracles, really, because anything can happen. And it's very fresh. In this way, life becomes joy and excitement instead of just a humdrum way of living.
As you walk into the forest, I'm wondering if you could share how the forest speaks to you.
Well, the forest would speak to me in a sense of, well, I feel its greenness, it's quiet, and feels like it's enveloping me in a body of quiet and protection. Whatever happens there, whether I hear birds or animals or see different things, that's how it speaks to me, in what it offers, its gifts, its beauty. That's how it speaks.
From this inspiration, you write poetry, as you shared earlier, and I'm wondering if you'd be kind enough to share with everybody a special poem.
I'd love to.
Okay.
And this poem called Cedar Grove, and it's about walking in the woods. Before the day opens its bright umbrella, drawing me into its silky fold, I enter the grove of cedars by the creek. A silence so deep, all thought disappears in darkened air. Morning waiting to be opened, its lumy aromas of new leaves, flowers, light weaving golden strands across the forest floor, where my feet move slowly through saffron cedar seeds. To know the forest is to know a thousand secrets, I think. Then green lushness carries me into its silent curves, till I grow resplendent in the dark bodies of trees, where ravens nested for weeks. Their raucous cries gone now, in the softness of boughs, parting to let through the sun's long, smoking fingers of light.
Oh, my heavens, all I want you to do is read it again. That's how I feel. It feels to me a very relaxing, calming, deep, healing energy. Is that how your poems hit you sometimes, or other people?
Yes, I believe so, because when you're in a state of harmony and wholeness, it's a very healing state. That's what happens when I walk in the forest, and that's the state I write in. There is a wholeness there, and that's very conducive to healing.
Is there a way, from your experience and from teaching classes, that you would recommend that people move forward with that?
Yes, the way I write and the way I teach is to just open completely. And that is a simple process of just sitting and breathing deeply and then watching your breath and coming into a softness, a stillness, and just noticing any sensations that may arise. When you're ready, you would just pick up your pen and start to write anything. It doesn't matter what you're writing. You're just connecting with the page. You're just writing one word after the other, regardless of what it is, letting it flow so that, you know, the words are flowing onto the page. And you may write about your walk. You may write about the flowers in your garden. You may write about anything, but not to fixate on what you write about it. Just let it pour out of you. But I think if you are experiencing some part of nature and then sitting down to write, chances are something of that will come onto the page. And not to even worry whether it comes into the shape of a poem. You can shape that later. It's just getting the essence of your feeling onto the page. So it's very simple, and anyone can do it. The other thing that you may do, if you don't have a place that you're walking or looking, is to sit there and write, use that method to write what you're grateful for the day. Often that inspires some interesting writing. I often find myself doing that as well, because when you're in nature, you're often appreciating the beauty, so that's a form of gratitude.
Oh, I love that. It makes me want to run outside and sit in my garden and wait for that inspiration. And I loved when you said capturing the essence. That's what's important, not having your mind set on, I have to create a poem or I have to create a writing. It's to be present
exactly.
with the essence and really savor that and experience it.
Yes, that's true. When you let go of the goal and just sink into the experience, it becomes very real, and you don't have to make an effort to achieve anything. It just comes through you. So you are capturing the essence of what it is you're writing.
I like that. You've been doing this for a while. You've had your daily practice and you've been connecting with nature. I'm wondering, have you noticed any benefits to your general health or well-being, or even anything that your students have reported to you after taking a workshop?
Yes, my health has improved dramatically. More balanced, very few health issues, feeling of harmony. And in answer to the question about my students,
mm-hmm.
my students tend to experience the same thing. For instance, I just did a Greek writing workshop on Salt Spring on the weekend, and many of the participants had big breakthroughs in their writing. Often this comes about in the form of maybe there's a memory or an experience they haven't been able to write about at all. It's been kind of stuck inside their bodies. And when they open, as they do in these workshops, they just naturally write it onto the page, and they're always quite surprised and delighted too, because it's a release,
mm-hmm.
especially if it's a traumatic experience. It's on the page out of their body.
Gee, what's coming to me is that it's a release and a relief.
Yes, especially if they've been wanting to write it for a long time but haven't had the space, the sacred space to do the work. And so that's what we create. We can create a very safe and supportive container for people to write.
Can you offer some tips to someone who might be motivated or inspired to create a daily practice, but they're kind of reluctant to do that because they think they might be too busy?
Yes, well, the first thing will be the intention, to create a strong intention. Even if you have only 10 or 15 minutes, you might get up 10 or 15 minutes earlier. That's usually the best thing to do. And just ask yourself, what would I love to do? Or what would really inspire me? And go with that. And it could be anything. It could be doing a bit of yoga, then going for a walk, then sitting with your journal for 10 minutes and writing out what you're grateful for. You might also, and this is something I do, is say a prayer as well.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps a loving kindness prayer or anything that you feel might calm you or inspire you. But just go with your intuition and experiment. Soon you'll come up with a routine that works for you and that will set you for the whole day. You'll be so nourished and inspired that it will completely revitalize your whole being and set you on a path of wholeness for the day.
I know that there's a link between, because we talked a little bit about this before, between having a daily practice and writing, or however you choose to express yourself, express the essence, and breakthroughs. So I'm wondering if you could share a little bit of how that looks when you're offering a course. And particularly, I'm interested in the breakthroughs. Like, what is a breakthrough, and how does that look when people are experiencing them, and how do you support them?
Well, a breakthrough would be, for instance, in the workshop that I did on the weekend,
mm-hmm.
one woman hadn't been able to write for months. And as soon as we did the meditative practices, she was writing volumes, and she wrote about the joy of writing, of just putting her pen to paper. And it's a release, and a joy.
Okay.
And it's simply just an opening. That's what a breakthrough is. You give yourself permission to let the flow move through you. That's basically what it is. And often we block it through our limiting thoughts, such as, I can't write, I don't have time to write, I don't have the talent to write. So it's just letting these go and just opening and not being so concerned about what it is you're producing, but rather just the joy of writing. And being.
I like that a lot. If a person was interested in talking with you or taking one of your workshops, how would they get a hold of you?
It's very easy. You can just go to my website, www.lorrainegain.com, and look at all my offerings. I'm doing lots of online courses, some upcoming retreats in Ontario this summer. And you can just simply email me. There's a contact button that you can hit, and I will be delighted to respond to any inquiries.
Now, with your online courses, Lorraine, what do they look like? Because as you were naming off what you have, your retreats, your online courses, are they usually a specific amount of time?
Yes, some of my online courses are short, such as 6 weeks. I've just been running one called Open Truth, and that's 6 weeks. Another one could be 3 months. In the fall, I'm starting a six-month mentoring program for those who are wishing to write some kind of book but don't really know how to begin, what to do. So this will take people through the whole process, and it could be any kind of book. In these courses, I give one-on-one phone consultations. I send them emails. I do teleconferences. So people are very supported in the work that they do. And then they send me their writing, and I give feedback on the writing.
Would this be a week-to-week commitment or a couple of times a week? How does that part look?
Well, it varies, but generally people would have to be doing some kind of work every week just to move forward with their writing. They would receive emails every week, depending on the course. I would talk to them periodically. So each course is different, but there is a constant connection.
This particular mentoring course or online course would be ideal for people in the healing profession because they already are so connected with source or nature. They would really get what you're communicating to them.
Yes, I think anyone who is wishing to connect to their source in any way would benefit. And often healers have something to say. They might have a book that's ready to be birthed, but they don't know how to go about it. But there is a great need now in the world for positive, inspiring, creative books.
Yeah, excellent.
And for people to be writing articles and all kinds, you know, blogs, any type of writing that will help communicate transformation.
I imagine you are very much in demand and have a fulfilling and filled year coming up.
As I mentioned, I'm going to Ontario. I'll be giving some retreats there. One of them is called Nurturing Our Wholeness. I will be editing some books. I have just finished a writing book that I'm hoping will find its publisher and be published next year. I have two collections of poetry that may come out next year as well. I have lots of online courses starting in the fall.
To honor Lorraine and her connection with nature, before we started our conversation together, I threw open the windows. And as I sit here in Sebastopol, California, I can hear birds tweeting and chirping away. As you were speaking, Lorraine, and every time you speak, they just start chirping. I think they're with us. I'd love for you just one more time to share your website.
www.lorrainegain.com.
Excellent. And I would love for you to come back on the show maybe in about 6 or 9 months. And I'd also really like to have a conversation. You had mentioned that there's a need right now for lots of healing in the world, and people can help balance that equation or add their healing, specific healing element to that through the writing of blogs or articles. So I'd love to explore that a little more with you.
I'd love to do that.
Oh, excellent. Thank you for being on the show and sharing your wisdom and your heart and your spirit and your beautiful poem. And you have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much, Mildred. Thank you. I really enjoyed being on the show.
Yes, we've added to our lineup of lively, thought-provoking shows. But don't forget our original Sunday morning lineup at 10:30 a.m. Join us for Healing Conversations with Mildred Lynn McDonald every first Sunday. Revolution with Heisey Lutmers every second Sunday. Convergence with John Carosella every third Sunday. And our popular on-air call-in show, the fourth Sunday of every month. We're excited. Give us a listen as we continue to create new and entertaining ways for you to shine your inner light. Join us at Firefly Willows, LIVE. Thank you for joining us. This program was brought to you by Firefly Willows, LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Carosella. Please join us next time on Firefly Willows, LIVE, for A Shamanic Life with John Carosella, Tuesday evening at 8 p.m.